This film is not the kind of film that you just like sit back and just watch. Like this is, I forgot how intense this film is in terms of, it's like a thick movie, like writing wise and
This is one of the earliest films I remember being like, let me pay attention to this.
it's
And
true.
it's not, because in the end, because, I mean, a lot of, well, it depends. Like, I like to break things up, I think I've said this before, but into movies and films. And definitely, I mean, the career of PTA, like, and what I consider, like, a movie to me is like popcorn entertainment, and not that you're supposed to be, obviously, on your phone or not paying attention as much, but there's just stuff that you can put on in the background. This is not a background. This is a world that you go
Look,
in.
in this day and age, we always have our phone in one hand, we're doing something else, we're doing like a million things at once. This is not the kind of film that you can really do that with if you really want to pay attention to the plot, which is obviously what we do here. So I guess we'll just dive into this one, right?
Deep end, baby.
Okay.
Iggy Pop! Amen! Let it rock! I'm a fucking idiot.
Red meat, we crave sustenance.
I'm an artist.
Hello, my name is Jimmy Capote.
Why don't you have some fun?
Fun, fun.
Tommy.
That's a okay, thing.
Whoever she is, I'm gonna find her and I'm gonna hurt her.
I've spent the past 3 years learning Finnish!
I'm always home, I'm uncool.
This is a process of dehumanization.
Shut up!
Hi, Hoff fans. Welcome to this week's edition of the PS I Love Hoffman podcast, our love letter to the remarkable career of the late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman. I'm Brian Rodriguez.
And I'm Kyle Reinfried.
We're always home, we're always uncool, and we're always ready to talk great movies. And today, we have another great PSH, PTA collaboration. Kind of a heavy one today.
Yeah, Magnolia. This is, there's a lot going on in Magnolia.
Yeah, and as I mentioned to you guys before, this is a 3-hour film. Previously, we've spent like 2 hours talking about an hour and a half film. You know, we're not going to sit here and talk for 4 hours as much as we would like to do that.
Well, 3-hour film, it deserves three people to talk about it.
Yes, exactly. And we are joined by a guest today, filmmaker Tim O'Connor. Tim.
Hello.
Tim.
P.T. Anderson fan, correct?
I would say so, yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah. Tim, nice to meet you. We haven't met before. This,
good to meet
sitting
you.
Here.
Yeah. Shaking hands. Yeah, thanks for inviting me to talk about the PSH.
Yeah. I mean, heard that you're a big PTA fan, which...
Paul
yeah.
Thomas Anderson, for
Paul
those,
Thomas
yes.
Anderson, yes. If you're tuning in, this is your first episode, and you don't know who PTA is, that is Paul Thomas Anderson. He is one of the most brilliant... filmmakers, we'll go with living filmmakers, but I'd say one of the most brilliant filmmakers out there, especially for his age bracket. And he had great success with his the previous film before this, Boogie Nights. And so he learned from his first film, Heart Eight, which we've covered both, because again, Philip Seymour Hoffman was in both of those.
Yep.
But he had a lot of problems with the studio with Heart Eight. And then he learned for Boogie Nights for him to have Final Cut, and that is again what he had here and why he got to make a 3-hour and 8-minute movie.
Yes, a 3-hour, 8-minute movie where it rains frogs.
Right.
Yeah.
And basically Boogie Nights gave him the right to do that.
Yeah, apparently New Line, the deal that he had with New Line was you get Final Cut, and the only thing that they knew was the title.
So, wow.
That's awesome.
You know. To get, you have to have a movie as successful as Boogie Nights, I think, in order to get that. And, you know, it'll never happen again.
No.
For anybody, I don't think.
No, I mean, that's unprecedented.
Yeah.
So before we get into the film, we like, since you're a first-time guest, we'd like to ask our guests a couple questions.
Sure.
First one being, what was the first film you saw Philip Seymour Hoffman in? Or, like, that
or
you, like,
noticed,
that
or...
noticed, recognized his performance?
Yeah, I was thinking about it, and I sort of am... hazy, but just glancing through his IMDb page, it must have been Patch Adams.
Wow.
I don't remember what his role was, but I remember seeing that movie in a friend's basement and being disturbed by it. So, which is a weird movie to be disturbed by, but
it's got some heavy stuff too.
Yeah, I don't know.
Who does he play in that movie?
He's
one
like,
of the patients?
No, he's like this pretentious roommate of Patch Adams.
Yeah, so
like
they're going through med school at the same time, and he's someone that he's like, I study, like, I came from a family of doctors, like, there's no time for silly haha, like,
yeah.
Very, you know. not the jovial PSH that we know.
Yeah, that's a movie that, again, we've discussed, that did not carry well today.
No, I mean, it's just, it. I mean, for, not that the film wanted to be like a Magnolia, but what, but what
well,
Magnolia,
you never know.
What like Paul Thomas Anderson does is he creates these films that get award recognition, and that's, I mean, again, I thought Patch Adams was just a very like Scream, like gimme kind of movie.
Right.
But
I couldn't even tell you what the plot is, except that it involves like psychiatry, and there's a scene where somebody jumps out of a closet, and it was, right? Am I imagining this?
Yeah, I think that's the squirrel guy, right?
And somebody gets stabbed, right?
No, she gets shot. Well, shot? Yeah.
Or there's somebody in a house.
Oh,
well,
that
this
one.
Is, this
yeah,
is actually
no,
this is perfect yeah. because we were talking about this oh, recently, boy. Where when you haven't seen something for a while, you start creating,
right?
You know, like
alternative yeah. scenes and lines and yeah. just happenings and.
Which is, I mean, which is that's all you have to remember. Patch
yeah,
Adams,
yeah.
Really. Not,
so
no, again, not,
anyway,
no offense, Patch Adams, but we're here to talk about a much much better film.
Yeah,
but
the second question.
Second question, yes, being that, what is your favorite Philip Seymour Hoffman movie and/or role?
Hmm. Well, I would probably go with one of the PTA movies.
Okay.
But I think that, like, his character in Boogie Nights is just, like, the saddest, most, like, heartfelt.
That's popular,
yeah.
actually.
Scotty,
yeah.
Scotty J.
Man,
I have
that
such
is
a soft spot for
so,
Scotty J.
It's true.
So sad and, like, lonely and relatable. And it's, that one's great. But I think, like, you know, you put those scenes from The Master where he's interviewing Joaquin Phoenix in
oh
front of me.
God.
And I'll
yeah.
just, you know, I could watch those on repeat.
Yeah.
All through the night.
That's
so.
Just that's a film that, I mean, it's towards the end of this show, so I'll be sad that we're getting towards the end of his career in the show,
right.
but I cannot wait to get to it.
Yeah, yeah, it's just like, you know, there is like a, you know, there's kind of like a category of performances that just stand above,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yep.
others, and I think that is certainly one of them. I also think he's amazing in The Savages, which is also later.
Yep.
Him
and Laura Linney, that's just a great.
And that's sort of, you know, whereas like The Master is sort of like this dazzling, you know, kind of
yes.
like,
big, yeah.
you know,
broad film.
Yeah, like a big, that's a like a big canvas, you know, painting on the side of a church, and
yeah.
and like The Savage is like a little sketch of a performance. Not saying it's better or worse, but it's just, you
no,
know.
It's just a much more intimate film.
Yeah.
Range, you know.
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah, that's
it's always a testament. And to go back to, again, to you saying Scotty J, you just think of that movie, and again, this is you know, Boogie Nights and Magnolia are by far his biggest like ensemble like
mm-hmm.
movies. Just to say that out of that movie of Boogie Nights with tremendous performances, people just like really felt for Scotty J and just
yeah.
really reigns to his acting.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah,
for sure.
I mean, you hear that from a lot of people. Just like that, again, I mean, we've talked about it in other shows too.
Mm-hmm.
Just that scene outside with the car.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
It's yeah, that scene in particular. And it's amazing because that entire movie is essentially like, you know, a dozen people having the same arc, which is like nobody understanding them and being alone in the world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody having that kind of situation, and that he stands out above
yeah,
very similar characters is.
And again, it doesn't have that many lines. It's just
yeah,
yeah. And
it's very visual too.
This film too. I mean, it's, you know, he has a bit more to do and more of a pivotal role. Like he really, I mean, he brings Tom Cruise's character.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Versus, I mean, Scotty J. You know, he has his own like little thing, but definitely, I love his Phil Parma is his name in this
right.
movie.
Right. Well, I'm assuming his name is Phil because Paul Thomas Anderson knew he was going to put him in it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Supposedly, essentially every role, every major role in this movie, he had an idea of who. And in fact, I apparently he wrote roles for other people, notably Mark Wahlberg. He wrote a role for there's a couple of roles that he wrote into the script, and then when the actors turned them down, just took them out.
A big
wow,
one,
really?
A big,
That's
a big
cool.
one was George C. Scott.
Right.
And I don't
really?
Know if he was up for the Jason Robard character or the Philip Baker Hall character.
That, yeah, my understanding was that he was going to play the dying guy.
Okay.
But the reason he wrote it for Jason Robards, but then Jason Robards actually got really sick. And
yeah, so wasn't sure if he was going to be able to be in it. But George C. Scott, literally, that would have been another three-name. Yeah. But he threw the script, like, across the table and said, this is the biggest piece of crap I've ever read.
Really?
Wow. Which... sure, this film isn't like your traditional movie, so for a actor like George C. Scott, is just like, what the hell is going on?
He clearly wasn't too familiar with his, like, Paul Thomas.
No, but I would think if I was, like, George C. Scott's agent, I would have been like, yeah, but did you see, like, Burt Reynolds in Boogie Nights?
George C. Scott's agent is probably, like, twice the age of George C. Scott, like some immortal Hollywood
he's just
agent.
He's
like,
just a mummy.
Kid, don't take it. I got you a better part.
Yeah.
No, but that's so interesting that he literally just, like, eliminated the roles. How big was this screenplay, if that's the case?
Apparently,
well,
who knows if he's making this up or not, but supposedly he went to a cabin in the woods that
was owned... It was William H. Macy.
Yeah, owned by William H. Macy. And apparently, the story goes, he saw a snake outside the house and got afraid of the snake, and he couldn't leave the house... so he just stayed inside and wrote this script. And apparently it's like 220 pages long or something.
Yeah,
and
in like a week's time he wrote a majority of the screenplay. But the first thing that he wrote was actually for the character of Claudia, Melora Walters, who was in Boogie Nights. She played, I forget her character's name, but she's the one that ends up with Bucky, with Don Cheadle's character. And so she was a big, important start to just writing this screenplay, and she is somebody that you can get, like, a lot of other John C. Reilly's character and then Philip Baker Hall, and, like, obviously a lot of people will spiderweb off of that. But they took a line that she says in the restaurant is from the Amy Mann song that's used in this, and then they did the music video with, like, the characters from Magnolia. But it's that whole line of, like, would you forgive me. Do you remember the exact
Oh,
it's
yeah.
something like it's something like I'm so glad that we met. Now, can we never see each other again, or something like this? Yeah,
Would you be happy if you never saw me again?
Right. Yeah,
not
yeah,
doing it justice.
Yeah. No, but we're not doing good rendition here. But
but that's the line he uses. A line from the song, the Amy Mann song, and that was just like inspiration for this movie.
Gotcha. Yeah, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was surprising to me that he said that the first two things that he had were the title Magnolia and the image of that actress smiling into the lens.
Wow.
Which, as we know, is the last shot of the movie. So,
yeah, and the really interesting thing of Magnolia is, I mean, we're just doing a bunch of, like, trivia and facts right now, but so Magnolia is a street in San Fernando Valley, so that, like, is pretty much where, like, PTA grew up. And that's, like, supposedly this all happens within, like, a square mile, all this stuff. But the Magnolia can be seen in every scene, like, in the background.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like, a picture, a painting, so on someone's shirt.
I'm loving this trivia. This
yeah. And the other thing that became actually a joke is that I read this, and then I was watching a great interview with, Charlie Rose.
Yeah.
And Paul Thomas Anderson admitted that he didn't know about the frog, like, story from the book of, you know, like, Exodus.
Yeah, it's a biblical story.
Yeah, it's a biblical story involving Moses and, you know, let my people go and all that good stuff. But it's from Exodus 8:2, and that's seen over 100 times in the movie because he realized, one of the producers brought it to his attention that the frogs falling from the sky is in the Bible, and so it just became an ongoing joke. So there's, point being, in the TV studio, people are holding up signs that say it.
That's cool.
When the rain stops on the, like, the street and lights turn back on, there's, like, a bus stop, you know, with a sign that says 8-2 on it.
Is it a car crashes or something in that shot? Yeah.
It's point being that, like, between Magnolias and the 8:2, or just even any rendition of, like, 8-2.
There's so much going on in this movie that, like, it's definitely not what I'm, like, looking out for.
Oh, of course.
Like, Easter eggs.
Yeah, this is a...
It's really funny to think of somebody who hasn't seen this before just listening to this conversation, us just, like, casually mentioning frogs falling out of the sky.
Yeah. Well,
like,
speaking
a possibility.
Of which,
yeah.
Kyle, you always do these.
Mm-hmm.
Did you write a summary for us?
I did.
I don't know how you're going to do it.
Yeah. I kept it short again, and I will prelude it with, again, in this Charlie Rose interview, he's just like, what's this movie about? And Paul Thomas Anderson went, like, I don't know what it's about. It's like, I don't have anything, like, what can I say? I could talk forever what it's about.
The power to just be able to, like...
Yeah, exactly. Like, but he's like, but he said, in the end, it's about the relationship between parents and children and what went wrong. So that's what he kept it as simple. So I'll just go a little bit more and say that Magnolia is the wide but intimate story of a sex guru, a cop, a coke addict, a game show host, a trophy wife, and many more as they come to terms with each of their own lives.
Fair.
I mean,
simple.
Please add to it.
Yeah. That sounds about right. I mean,
is there another film like this? Like, obviously you have your movies, like nowadays they have all those holiday movies that there's all the separate stories.
No, yeah. Compare this.
No, I know, exactly. But I'm just like...
Valentine's Day or New Year's. What isn't now? No, Robert De Niro is in the New Year's one.
Yeah.
He's like, a New Year's Eve.
Anything could happen. Yeah. In New York, anything could happen.
Yeah, I think it...
Is there another movie like this? Like, he drew inspiration from movies like Network and, like, Nashville for Boogie Nights, and then they also watched... There's fantastic... I have this on Blu-ray, and there's great special features, and they have this really intimate, like, making of it.
Oh, yeah, it's amazing.
It's so good, and so good. There's just...
It's on YouTube, too.
What's that?
Yeah.
It's on YouTube.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is it? Yeah? Okay. Awesome.
I haven't seen it. I gotta check it out.
We'll put the link up for you folks. And it just covers from pre-production to, like, actually ends kind of with...
premiere.
Yeah, the premiere. Actually, him winning the Golden Bear. We've mentioned this before, the Golden Bear Award in Berlin. Yeah. But it's just the pre-production. He's just like, I hate pre-production. I can't wait till we start shooting.
Yeah.
And then, but, like, I just love that they were showing their... They were screening Network, and he was describing Network to, like, you know, his inner circle. And then he was like, okay, and next week we're going to watch Ordinary People. Like,
oh, wow.
the making of is totally worth it. And it's, I mean, if nothing else, it's just, like, seeing this guy's life. He was, like, what, like, 29 or something?
That part.
He looks like a kid. He's just, like, running around, like, so excited.
Smoking cigarettes at every chance he can get.
And there's just, like, a room full of, like, the most high-powered, like, Hollywood professionals sitting around a table, like, listening to his every word. He's dating Fiona Apple. It's just, just, like, he's living like, this,
hell?
Like, crazy.
What the hell?
What a life.
You know,
imagine making
life.
This
just
movie
hanging
in
out.
Your 20s.
Yeah, and then, like, he's hanging out with, you know, like, John Bryan.
And Elliot Smith, all the coolest people.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
seriously?
John Bryan, who's used to score his movies before, what's his name from Radiohead now?
Johnny Greenwood.
Johnny Greenwood.
Yeah, we saw.
There Will Be Blood.
Brian, I saw live. Not
at the United Palace down the road.
Yeah. The orchestra playing it live and Johnny Greenwood there playing the synthesizer.
Wow.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah, it was awesome.
But damn it, I'm so jealous. Elliot Smith, really.
Yeah, people, fans, watch this making of. I've never seen a making of like this before.
Well, they don't really make the making ofs too much anymore.
Now they're much more commercial and safe. This was like, he was just like, I'm wondering who shot it,
because it's like, it's clearly somebody who had access to him personally.
Said the name at the end, and I didn't actually take a chance to look it up.
But it's interesting because you get these moments. There's actually a good moment with him and Philip Seymour Hoffman where
there's a,
like,
couple of great moments.
Yeah. There's one in particular that where they're talking about one of the scenes where the Philip Seymour Hoffman character is just. It might even be the scene where he calls the bodega to get the porno magazines.
Yeah.
And Paul Thomas Anderson is making fun of Philip Seymour Hoffman.
He's mocking, and, like, his, like, mannerisms.
And it's funny to think that, like, that was what people thought of him at that point. You know, this pre-Capote PSH,
so
where,
my
like,
God.
He's, like, this bumbling, kind of, like, awkward guy. Yeah. And, like, to imagine that he turns into Lancaster Dodd, you know, eventually.
Yeah, we definitely have to link this to our Facebook.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean... It's really funny. There's just a couple of moments. They're also at, like, a press thing, and you're hearing, they're in the room, and Paul Thomas Anderson is just laughing, watching all these screens, because he just, like, obviously hates this whole process of filmmaking, and, you know, like, going around and just selling it. But you hear Philip Seymour Hoffman, he's being interviewed at that point, and he's talking about Patch Adams, and the guy's like, oh, great year, like, you know, like, you're coming strong off of Patch Adams, and I mean, it, like you said, he makes fun of him for, like his little mannerisms and that too. And then at one point he's listening to a jazz piece that John Bryan was like scoring and recording for the movie, and like you just see like Philip Seymour Hoffman like sitting against the wall in the background. It's like these guys, like they were just like, he loved him so much.
Yeah,
and
there's a really there's a great little scene in the making of where like it's Philip Seymour Hoffman and Jason Robards rehearsing one of the scenes around the bed, and PTA just kind of like leaning back and watching them practice. And at one point, Jason Robards just like stops, and it's just like, oh, I screwed it up, you know, like I stepped over your line or something. And Paul Thomas Anderson is just like, no, it was great. Let's shoot it, you know. And like just that spirit seems to be what was, you know, infused throughout the movie, sort of like, which is nice.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it just seemed like a really, like, William H. Macy is also hysterical in this making of.
Oh, is it?
And yeah. Let's go over the cast. Okay. So we've got Frank T.J. Mackey, Tom Cruise. I'll go into a little story of how they met and how he came onto this. Earl Partridge is Jason Robards. Linda Partridge is Julianne Moore. Phil Parma, Philip Seymour Hoffman. Claudia Wilson Gator is Melora Walters. Jimmy Gator, Philip Baker Hall. This is just, you can't tell it, but just because he's been in movies before, I included him. A young Jimmy Gator, right in the beginning of the film, is played by Tom Jane.
Oh, cool.
And then you've got Quiz Kid, Donnie Smith is William H. Macy, and then Officer Jim Curing is John C. Reilly.
There's a lot more, obviously, characters. Yeah, there's a lot of collaborators, PTA collaborators, and later Philip Seymour Hoffman collaborators, like Ricky Jay.
Yeah, and
Luis Guzman is in this.
Luis Guzman,
as I saw in the credits.
Alfred Molina,
yeah.
Yeah. It's just, there's tons and tons of people.
And I mean, I think so far on our tally, Julianne Moore has been in the most films with Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Mm. You had mentioned like things like other movies like this of like you know, things that he might have been inspired by, and I wonder if it's at one point he went and he ghost directed on A Prairie Home Companion.
Really?
Because he was crazy about Robert Altman, hugely inspired by Robert Altman.
Okay.
So I would say the only really thing that I can think of in like at least in American movies would be Altman movies. So I mean, the best example being Nashville, I think, is probably, yeah, you know, that and Shortcuts being the closest things to Magnolia that I can think of. But for the most part, like, yeah, this just doesn't exist.
It's just really interesting. And so also interesting how they filmed it is that Paul Thomas Anderson actually had the opportunity to have the actors, like, for the, like, them for like, let's say, 10 days in a row. So like he shot everything, their scenes, in chronological order, but not that the movie was shot in chronological order. As far as for like, it was very good for him collaborating with the actors and obviously the actors for their performance.
How many times did they have to do that frog thing then? I guess they would have to do it that many times anyway, but
yeah, I mean, it's it's just
every day, every
it
like
was last, a different location.
Yeah, so almost every last day for an actor would be Frog Day.
Exactly. Yeah. That's cool. I like that. But yeah, so that was, I mean, that helped as far as scheduling like Tom Cruise. And so I said before,
sure,
like it was, he actually called Paul Thomas Anderson after Boogie Nights and said, I want to work with you on something. And so PTA got to travel over to London, and he went on to the set of Eyes Wide Shut. He got to meet Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah,
this guy's just like
Stanley
lives the best life.
Yeah. Stanley Kubrick.
And again, he was younger than this, so like he was like probably like 28 years old.
Yeah,
and like
cool.
Like, and supposedly the thing, I remember seeing an interview with him at some point, and he said like the thing that he really, that like Kubrick said that like he took to heart was that Kubrick said, he was just like, what, you know, give me anything. Tell me what can I learn from you? And Kubrick just said, like, just be a good writer. And he said, that's what I like about your movies. You're a good writer.
Wow.
And that, which is kind of surprising, I feel like, coming from Kubrick.
Formal, I was going to say.
You know, kind of like obsessive, aesthetically oriented director.
Thought it was going to be something about like the system and like, you know.
I find it interesting.
And that's amazing.
Yeah.
What a unique intro to this movie. These like three vignettes of, you know, like under, like one is the
and Ricky Jay is the narrator.
And he is, yeah, he's also, really? Yeah, he's in the movie, he's the producer of Jimmy Gator's show.
Yeah.
But he's right. also, he plays the narrator. And I love it, even at the, like, the end of the movie, as the narrator, he says, as the humble narrator, strange things happen all the time. Like, yeah. even as the narrator's confused in a way.
Right.
Yeah.
But he's just giving these, like, three, what, like, what are these three, like, sequences? We've got the, it's the Greenberry Hill murder.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pharmacist, and he's killed, like, the name of the place is Greenberry Hill, but then it's three different people that have the last names of Greenberry and Hill.
Yeah. Right.
Kill him.
Yeah.
So, like, that's, like, an odd, and then there's that, like, constant, like, that riddle I've heard before of there's a fire in the woods and a scuba diver is in the tree. Like, how did this happen? And that's played by Patton Oswalt. That's
right.
pretty,
yeah.
<That's> like a fun little, you know, character for him to play. I mean, no dialogue, but he was scuba diving and then there's a fire in the forest and a plane scoops him up and drops him as with the water into the trees. And then the last one is, and then also the pilot of the plane, like, assaulted him the day before because he was in a,
right.
like, a gambler.
Right.
And Patton Oswalt is a, you know, does, like, runs a table at a casino. And then the last one is this weird crime of this kid is going to jump off of the roof and commit suicide, but he would have not died because there was a net put there for the window washers or something. But at the same time, his parents, who argue all the time and say they're going to kill one another all the time, is the reason he wants to kill himself. They're getting into an argument, which the son put bullets into the gun,
right.
and then the woman ends up shooting the gun. I mean, this is like, how do you even make this stuff up? Like, did he read? Was that a true? I heard the Greenberry Hill was an actual true crime.
Oh, really?
But then they figured out those three guys actually didn't kill, so that was an open-ended, like, case
yeah.
or whatever. But point being, there's these three little things. I mean, what is this showing? Is this showing chaos and then coincidence, like these themes that are just playing throughout this film of Magnolia?
Yeah, I was thinking it's such a bold way to start. I just feel like at every I have like this strange feeling about this movie because it's I think I've probably only seen it all the way through, like, start to finish in a sitting twice, but there's been many times where I've just taken it in chunks,
mm-hmm.
and it's, like, there's just so many ideas in, like, every scene there's something good happening, and whether or not, you know, it all comes together, I think is up for debate, but, like, the you know, this opening just, like, set it, there's so much energy in it, the way that he shot the murder scene on, like, a old Pathé hand wound camera.
Yeah.
But you know, so it was probably this huge creaky ancient camera Jeez. Technology, but he's putting them on these crazy there's these crazy crane shots that he's known for, you know,
yeah.
that are used in that scene. The dolly moves in the scuba diving sequence and the kid with the shotgun are so fast and so energetic.
Yeah.
It's hard to say what it means, but there's just, like, this kind of, like, you know.
And the narrator even mentions them again at the end.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But it's just, it's one of the, I mean, it's definitely higher level of understanding than I can slightly, you know, I mean, not that, I don't know if it is supposed to mean something specific, but obviously it goes into what this movie is, which is just like that strange things happening all the time. And so that definitely comes in with the frogs, clearly. But I thought, honestly, like, I thought, like, then you're just seeing the amount of frogs that are falling. I thought it was going to be like a plane, like a cargo plane, like dropped like frogs or something. Like, I don't know, something went wrong. No.
Yeah. Just leaves it unexplained.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just,
it's hard to say, except that it like puts you in a place, you know, it like, it's almost just like an appetizer or something. It's like it puts you into this like hyper energetic, like thing. It sort of sprinkles in some thematic elements. The scenes are really fun and weird and interesting.
Yeah.
You know, and then like it cuts to music and the title comes up and then like
Great cover of One is the Loneliest Number.
Yeah. And then the thing I always think about how they cut to a shot of the sky and there's just the weather as yeah. a title card.
Yeah, partly
it's like,
cloudy.
Yeah, that's so...
It's just... I don't... Yeah, it's hard for me to say what it means except, like, strap in, people.
Yeah, partly cloudy, 82% chance of rain.
Yeah.
And then that happens three times throughout the film that then it says, you know, like, raining and, you know, 100% humidity.
Well, yeah. Well, what I always find funny about, like, P.T. Anderson is that he's not really a household name among the common folk, if you will. You know, like, that sounds like, again, very pretentious. But, like, my mother doesn't know who he is.
Yeah.
I mean, she's known these movies. She's seen Boogie Nights, you know, but it's not like... there are bigger names to her. And I was watching this film with my girlfriend, and I told her about it, and we started, and she's like, did you say Wes Anderson?
Right.
I'm like, no.
Yeah, well, that Anderson. Definitely doesn't
But again,
help.
Like, the beginning scene is just... It's like, it's so stylized like that I could see where she was coming from, is my point.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I had a teacher in film school who once said, you know, the last, in the past 5 years, the great movies have all come from Anderson. And somebody, or 10 years or something, and somebody asked him, Anderson, do you mean Wes or P.T.? And he goes, Wes, we're talking about adults. Which is like a really, you know, it's a very condescending thing to say.
No, it is, but like you get where it comes from.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
Digress.
Yeah. But, I mean, there's just all these little things in the beginning introducing us to the characters. We find T.J. Mackey, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tom
Cruise with long hair.
Yeah, exactly. That's this is the famous era of Tom Cruise, like Mission Impossible 2 kind of era.
And it's coming right after Eyes Wide Shut, where he's doing this like hyper repressed kind of like brooding character. You know, if Tom Cruise can be a serious actor, Eyes Wide Shut is probably the argument that you would make.
Yeah.
And this being like the total extreme opposite of that, just like the most on the surface. And it's great, you know, he's so good.
This just reminds me of like, you know, like when people started realizing Tom Cruise was like a bit off, you know, the rocker.
Yeah,
well,
totally.
Yeah, like the whole, it's funny he plays like this and then like the whole like him jumping on the couch thing on mm-hmm. Oprah and stuff. It's like you see that in him.
I was excited when he was like going to have a kid, right? Or something like that.
No, I think he just loved Katie Holmes.
Oh, just like, I love Katie Holmes.
Yeah, something like that. I don't know.
Whatever.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, and then with the rest of these characters, John C. Reilly, he has this whole great, his introduction is probably my favorite.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's just talking to himself, right? And just explaining the day.
Well, it's
being
this great.
A cop.
He has this like monologue, and there's a close up of him in the cop car, and it really, he's just a smart director, you know. Like he's got a close up that's from the side. John C. Reilly is talking, and it really, if the shot angle and the way that he's talking makes you think like, oh, he's talking to a reporter, or he's talking to a young cop, or he's giving somebody advice.
That's what I thought.
And then it cuts to a two shot, and there's nobody in the passenger seat. He's just talking to himself. It's
his partner, because then he goes into the meeting with the rest of the cops, and it's just like,
yeah,
he just has this. Just like, well, William H. Macy says this line, but I feel like, and that's why he and John C. Reilly have, like, ending moments together, but I think John C. Reilly just also has, like, so much, like, love to give. That's actually, that's what a lot of these characters are.
Yeah.
They're either people that have been broken by love, or just, and want to give.
Or, like, starving for it.
Yeah.
Especially love that you should expect, like, the love from a parent to a child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a lot of them are just broken by that, like the disappointment of that. Like, again,
the
parent is supposed to love their child, right?
Yeah, the two biggest being like T.J. Mackey and
Claudia.
She's also Frank, right? Frank T.J. Mackey.
Yeah,
and then Claudia. Yeah.
But what about the kid on the quiz show?
Oh yeah, and
William H. Macy.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, like this is.
Yeah,
it's throughout.
I guess in a weird way, I mean, it really is sort of like spiritually connected to Boogie Nights in the sense that like another ensemble movie about lost characters who are sort of on their own. But it's sort of, you know, if Boogie Nights is about ambition, this one is about family and like biblical existentialism or something.
Yeah, I mean, there is something to be said that Paul Thomas Anderson has now, like, he was saying, this is, like, back then, he was like, this is my best movie. I feel like Tarantino said that before, too.
Right.
Like, you know, like, it, like, the freshest thing is just like, yes, this is my masterpiece or whatever. But he was on a, there's this really great interview with Mark Maron that he just, like, he opened up with a lot, like,
yeah,
a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And he said, now, would you, like, now if you made it or if you go back and make a cut, like, would it be as long as it would? And he's like, no,
yeah,
it's too fucking
long.
He even says
yeah,
that?
Yeah,
wow.
he says he was
and
like,
he's like, I know there's things, I'm not going to say them, but I know there's things. Like, this is him. Like, I don't know.
Wow, that's
yeah.
He said there are things he knows that he would cut out. And so I'm very curious as to what they are and what, if you guys think, like, what are some of these characters, you know, like, that could have been, like, blended in a way.
I don't know. Like, I don't know what he exactly means. Or just, like, scenes or just...
Yeah, scenes or characters until, you know... Until
I don't know.
It wasn't that he wasn't...
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, I sort of, like, I guess a part of me is glad that it is the sprawling mess that it is, you know, because it's sort of, like, where its weird character comes from. And it's hard to, you know... who knows if he would have cut whole storylines or if he would have just shaved scenes down or something. But yeah, it's interesting to see. Apparently, when this started, he had just made Boogie Nights, a big, you know, I guess you could sort of call Boogie Nights an epic. It's like it covers a lot of time. There's a lot of characters.
Yeah, there was not many films being made like that at the time, obviously. Yeah.
And apparently, he wanted to make a small, intimate movie.
Yeah. And then something he could have shot with his friends, like, really easily.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But then it's interesting after he does this, and it's this big blowout thing, and at the end of actually, at the end of that making of, there's this great little moment where he's sitting in a cab, I think. And he just goes like, he's just like, you know, I just, he had just seen the premiere and he goes like, I just watched it and it just doesn't mean anything to me. and then he goes on, he makes Punch Drunk Love. He makes like the small.
Which is pretty much besides like Hard Eight, the smallest.
It's like, it's a 90 minute movie. It's small, it's contained.
We get to see our man Philip Seymour Hoffman again.
You do.
That's one of my favorite.
Yeah.
he's
great.
Small role, but.
Yeah.
Great role in the movie. So intense, but
so it's there's that quote that he said at right after the release PTA, I mean, where he said, like, for better or worse, this is the best movie I'll ever make. And in a way, I mean, I don't agree with him. I don't think it's his best movie, but I know what he means. You know, it's like the most that he could do. You know, like, there's the most ideas, it's the most,
yeah,
the boldest.
This is like him,
maybe.
Like, when, like, Brian Wilson was going all crazy with the
right.
Beach Boys, like,
yeah.
trying
yeah,
to create,
his
like, his
smile.
Manifesto.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's a good point.
Yeah.
But
this is...
You know?
This...
Like, no, it needs more didgeridoos.
Right. Like, exactly.
Some bassoons.
Fire
and some...
engines.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Exactly. Dogs barking.
What's crazy, again, not to hit on this again, but is that, what, like, he's 29.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, you know?
Right.
So he was in pre-production of this, like, when he was, like, in his, like, turning, like, 28, I guess.
Jesus. Well, before this becomes the Paul Thomas Anderson podcast,
yes.
Yeah,
let's go back to our guy Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so we're introduced to him, and he is that, like, this the, is it hospice, do you think, or is it,
like...
He's
like a home health care worker.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if he's a hospice specialist or whatever. He's like a home nurse.
Yeah.
But he's built up this pretty, like, good rapport relationship with Jason Robards' character.
By the way,
Kyle,
I know we always talk about his costume choices because he was a guy who liked to choose what he wore in films. Famously in Boogie Nights, he wanted the clothes smaller.
Yeah.
Apparently, this is one of the favorite things he's ever worn on film.
I mean, it must be nice to know, like, I just have to come in and put on my scrubs. Like,
like, I saw an interview with him, he's like, oh, God, I loved that shirt.
Which, it's got to be, like, slightly, like, open, flowy, comfortable.
Yeah, you know.
Like, you know, you don't have to worry about much. Like, he's just wearing, like, comfortable, like, Nike or, like, New Balance sneakers. But, he just plays this kind of, like, lovable. Like, he shows up for his, you know.
His rounds.
But, I mean, throughout this film, even towards the end, someone does show up to, you know, replace him.
And he's like, I'm going to see this one out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he knows Earl is probably on his way out. But he's just this simple, like, lovable, like, good-hearted, and just, again, has this great rapport with Earl.
But lovable in a believable way, not in, like, a mascot kind of way.
No, just, like, someone that you see that he also has, like, a passion for his, like, field, like, in, you know, in this, you know, of healthcare.
Yeah.
And Yeah.
Yeah. I read something interesting on the way over here that some the critic commenting that the Philip Seymour Hoffman character in this movie stands out because he's the only character who is not trying to fix something about themselves.
Oh yeah.
Which
yeah.
is kind of interesting.
That's cool.
You know, like he and he does sort of stand apart in that way where like you're relating to him in a different way. He does have I mean a lot of the characters have quests, you know, Philip what's his name? William H. Macy. So many triple names. It's crazy.
No, I was going to say William H. Macy's character, I think, unfortunately, is the one that you could just like cut.
Yeah. You know, every time I watch this movie and you get and you see him in that weird costume and he has braces or he's looking to get braces.
He's looking to get braces. And at the end, he breaks his teeth. And
right. Like, and I just get to the scenes with William H. Macy and I'm like, I gotta get through these, you know.
To me, his scenes just serve to kind of for the kid in the quiz show game.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah. Like what?
Which is like what a waste of William H. Macy.
Yeah, you're saying like serve as like what could have been,
what could be to,
or, I'm sorry,
what
I'm
could
sorry,
happen could to that kid? Yeah. But again, I agree. When you we didn't, I guess we didn't answer your question before. That's what I was gonna say.
Yeah.
That like that character.
Yeah, if you were gonna cut not scenes but a character, it would
see a Bill.
And he's fun. He's great in it.
Oh yeah, yeah, he's really good.
But even his redemption is not that like.
No.
I wouldn't even call it redemption, but it just his arc is just from top to bottom. Like,
right.
Yeah. But like, I got it from one scene basically.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman and like so his interactions are with. Earl and then Linda, right? That's mm-hmm. her
the,
name.
Julianne
Moore's character.
And then eventually right. Tom Cruise.
And then Tom Cruise.
Yeah. And besides for that like nurse character and like the telephone,
yeah.
Like, those are the only people he interacts with.
Yeah, I mean and he just has Jason Robards, I need to watch this man's like career because the few things I've seen him in. And this is
what has he been?
This is his last.
Yeah, he like died soon after this, right?
Yeah,
he said this is the best movie he'd ever make.
Yeah, he died of lung cancer, and I think in this movie it's supposed to be lung and then spread to his bones and stuff like that.
I think him in All the President's Men is. He plays Ben Bradley, and
I was like, where do I know this guy's face?
Yeah, and his voice.
Yeah.
If we were gonna do the thing like if it was the Jason Robards podcast, I would say that the two things I first recognized him in was Huck Finn, and then also he's in one of my favorite like little kid baseball movies. Little Big League, and he's the grandfather that gives.
Yeah.
The,
okay. Yeah. No. No, but he's great, and their interactions are just so. Human. I know that sounds like pretentious, but
yeah, it's almost. I've had people talk about this movie as being like embarrassing. Like it's embarrassing to watch those scenes. Like his performance in this one is kind of embarrassing. Not. I don't mean that in a bad way. It's just like you watch those scenes where he's like. There's just these long close-ups on him on the edge of the bed, like brimming with, like compassion for this dying man, and you're just kind of uncomfortable because you don't really know him very well. You know what I mean? This nurse, you don't really know what he's about. So you're kind of, and this movie is constantly doing that. This is, I have described it before as 3 hours of people crying for reasons you only vaguely understand.
That is a really good way to put it. But you feel something like in your stomach when you're watching this movie for like almost 3 hours.
Right. Yeah. It's all for better or worse. It's all very earnest. It's not, you know, not. People say it's melodramatic, and I guess in a sense it is in both a genre way and also, you know, it really goes for the high, you know, high emotional moments. But it does it in a very sincere way. You know,
this is a movie that at one point, I'm not going to say it breaks out into, like, a musical, but it has all their lead actors starting to sing to the same...
That the Amy Mann song.
Yeah, the Amy Mann
song. The different Amy Mann song.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
and it's just such a this movie stands alone for good or for worse.
Right. Know? Yeah, it's bad. I mean that sequence, I mean, I remember getting to that sequence seeing this movie for the first time. And I forget who starts singing first, but it's just, you know, these slow Dolly moves in as everybody starts singing to the song. And it's just like, that is what you go to the movies for. You know, like, yeah, I can't explain that, it. I don't know why that's good. I don't know what it means, but
it's such a unique film-going experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to get to that clip that we wanted to play.
Yeah, I think the first, the fun, you know, he has some conversation with Earl, but I like that Earl says to him that he has a son, mm-hmm. and so it's the character.
Yeah, we quickly learn that it's that Tom Cruise character.
Yeah.
Just, again, the ultimate, like, I don't know how to even describe
it. Yeah, let's just put it this way. The man is selling, like, you have to tame the pussy. He has a sign in the background when he speaks to men at, like, convention centers and in hotels. Like, it says, like, a pussy doesn't have 9 lives. Like, and he, you know, he says just cock and cunt, and he's just a very, like, I still don't understand exactly where all that came from. We learned that his mother passed away of cancer and he had to take care of her, but supposedly she was, like, a nice woman.
Right. And that, yeah, and that. Probably the Earl's true love. You kind of get the sense.
So, I was, yeah.
Yeah, he's sort of like this, you know, like, the kind of like hyper misogynist masculine,
and he's
alpha
just,
male.
He's teaching, you know, these guys, and you see the audience, and they're kind of like, you know, no offense, like loser guys. They're not like, he's not among his people. He's male empowerment.
Yeah,
as if that needed to be a thing.
Right.
Yeah, and so
there were. I mean, I remember like these kind of asshole guys existing in the world for real. There was, you know, they're out there. as over the top and ridiculous as clearly the Tom Cruise character is, it's like anchored in a real kind of like dangerous and horrifying undercurrent of the American male consciousness, you know.
For sure.
And so Phil Parma, Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, is having a hard time. Jason Robards gives him the wrong phone number.
Right.
And so then I thought, and this is, again, like, I'm still a little, like, damaged from Happiness, where he where he plays a very sexual deviant on the phone,
right.
Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, that is. And so when he calls, I don't know, like, first he's calling for food, but I guess it's a supermarket that will deliver or whatever. And he's asking...
Yeah, because, okay, again, like you said, this is his son, and he's trying to get them reunited before the death.
Yeah, but I don't know what this... We don't know what this phone call is for first, because he's saying he wants bread and
peanut butter
and cigarettes. And then he's like, you got a Playboy? And the woman's like... And it was actually kind of like a sexual, like, response. She's like, yeah.
Yeah.
And then he's like, I think then he says a hustler or a pen.
Both.
Yeah, no, but
both.
I forget what order, but he says a hustler. Yeah, and then, why am I reading the stuff that we want to play the clip? I totally forgot we wanted to play the clip. So.
All right. So let's throw to this clip.
Yeah.
Hi, I'd like to get an order for delivery.
Phone number?
818-725-4424.
Partridge?
Yeah.
What would you like?
I'd like to get an order of peanut butter. Cigarettes, Camel Lights, water.
Bottled water?
No. You know, forget the water. Just give me a loaf of bread. White bread.
Okay.
And, do you have Playboy magazine?
Yeah.
Okay, one of those. And, Penthouse, the magazine?
Yeah.
Do you have that? Okay, one of those. And, Hustler?
Yeah.
Do you have that? Yeah, that's it.
You still want the peanut butter bread and cigarettes?
Yeah. What?
The total is $31.90. 30 minutes or less.
Okay, thank you.
Is that cash or credit card?
Cash.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
So, yeah, as you like heard in that clip, like, I was like, where is this going? And the reward from it is that when this stuff is finally delivered, it's that he needed the other stuff, but he figured, oh, that guy's, the number will be, you know, it wasn't on TV at that time, so it was in the magazines, TJ Mackey's, you know, sex guru.
And I think the dialogue is great in that scene, but I think the thing that, like, at least performance-wise from our guy, PSH, just watching his face contort with agony as he transitions from buying peanut butter and cigarettes into buying, you know, the treasure trove of
it's that
beauty magazines is pretty – that's what it's all about.
I love that, but then I even love a little bit more his delight into knowing that this place has each of these. So again, that's why I was like, what is he going to be? Because right before he was scrolling through the TV, and again, I just wasn't putting two and two together. So he was looking to try to find it to like see the number on the TV. And I'm like, oh, now I get it.
Right.
But like, I guess, you know, Earl has a nice subscription to a, you know, naughty channel where like this, all of a sudden this woman's like, you know, it's a porno real close up of this woman's boob. And then he goes and he's calling on the phone for these, like, you know, three of the top, you know, like, porn magazines. And so I'm just like, what is he going to do? Like, is this the dark secret of Phil Parma?
Yeah, definitely the first time I saw this. That's what I thought. Like,
yeah.
I thought he was, I mean, again, he doesn't really have an ulterior motive.
Right.
He's so like sincere, but I'm looking for one because like everyone else kind of like has something there. And first time I saw this, again, I thought he was like maybe had a crush on the dying guy or something, or
we're waiting for this like dark. I mean, this is purely speculation. If I was gonna guess, maybe it's a sad, lonely job in the sense of dealing with sick people all the time.
Yeah.
So, like, not that he's finding like entertainment from it, but that's definitely like it's something for him, like more than his average.
Sure.
You know. A person that he's taking care of.
Yeah.
And not that, again, I'm not trying to really create like a scandal out of it, but like if that's what I was going to say, if there's any like ulterior motive, it's to make it a little bit more, again, exciting, entertaining. I don't know, you know, just to add a little something to his.
Well, the clip will play later in terms of like he's thinking of it as a movie. He even says it on the phone.
Yeah.
Just like this is like he's playing a part in something now.
Yeah, so, I mean, like I said, when he gets those magazines, he, you know, rips out the number and calls that, and he goes through this whole process of talking to first this guy on the phone that would be just obviously who you would place your order with or whatever you're getting from that subscription to TJ Mackey, and then finally, I guess that, you know, I mean, he says to that person, well, let's play that clip, right?
Yeah.
Hi. Hello, great. Is this Seduce and Destroy?
Yes, it is. Can I have your home phone number for the Eagles?
Okay, I don't want to order anything. You see, I have a situation. A situation has just come up that's really pretty serious, and I don't know who to talk to or what I should do, but maybe you could put me in touch with somebody if I explain myself? Could you? Okay. Could you connect me with just somebody else? You think? Okay, great. All right, let me try to explain myself without it seeming kind of crazy. But here you go. My name is Phil Parma, and I work for a man named Earl Partridge, Mr. Earl Partridge. And I'm his nurse, and he's a very sick man. He's a dying man, and he's sick. And he has asked me to help him find his son. Hello? Are you there? Hello?
No, I'm here.
Okay, you see, Frank T.J. Mackey is Earl Partridge's son. Well, there's no number for Frank in any of Earl's stuff, you know, and he's pretty out of it. I mean, like I said, he's dying of cancer. So.
What kind of cancer?
Oh, it's brain and lung.
My mother had breast cancer.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is she all right? Is she?
Oh, she's fine now.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it was scary though.
Oh, it's a hell of a disease.
Oh, it sure is.
Yeah.
So, wait, I'm sorry, so why call me?
I know this sounds silly, And I know that I might sound ridiculous, like this is the scene of the movie where the guy's trying to get a hold of the long lost son, you know, but this is that scene. This is that scene. And I think they have those scenes in movies because they're true, you know, because they really happen. And you gotta believe me, this is really happening. I mean, I can give you my number and you can go check with whoever you gotta check with and call me back, but do not leave me hanging on this. All right, please. I'm just, please. See, this is the scene of the movie where you help me out.
Yeah, I mean, that is as far as his, like, emotional, I mean, anchor in the movie, right? I mean, later on, it's more his reactions to Frank talking to Earl, and he has his little moment with Linda when Linda comes home, and he's all excited because he is getting Frank, you know, got Frank's contact information and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what do you guys think of this scene?
Well, the thing that I look at that and I think it applies to the last scene too. There's one shot in that scene. It's just like there is a confidence in the actors here and their ability to be all that you need to make it work. I mean, there's not – he could have shot the guy on the other end of that phone conversation and cut him up with, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance and like taken the best bits from different line readings and all this kind of stuff. But, you know, there is sort of – and I think it ties back into the fact that every role in this movie was, you know, PTA cast with certain people in mind. You know, he has confidence in these people. Clearly he has confidence in Philip Seymour Hoffman. And, you know, he just says, like, this entire scene is going to be one slow dolly push into his face. And we are going to rely on just, like, the power of the actor to do the scene. And it's, I don't know. It's nice. It's nice to see.
It is, and he brings it, you know, just like his hand and his just like.
Yeah, that's what
like,
I wrote.
This is that scene.
Yeah, you know? His gestures. Like Philip Seymour Hoffman is a very communicative with his hands.
Yeah.
And just even like his emphasis on words. Like I'm not trying to make like that sounds like a bad Shatner, but like. This is like, if Shatner was good, he'd be Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Right.
But I just love even, you know, so I've said this before, a big, you know, I mean, because Paul Thomas Anderson is very vocal of his inspirations. This is like one of those great, I mean, it is the Dolly Inn, like you said, but it does get to that intimate close-up, which is very Jonathan Demme.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, again, that's why it's, you know, along with the story that he's telling with this, like, you know, telemarketer, let's just call that guy, and he even says, oh, what kind of cancer? And it's like, oh, my mom, you know, had brain cancer, too. And it's like, oh, you know.
He wouldn't say, like, terrible. Like,
yeah. Because you know, he's seen, like, people at their, like, lowest moments. So this is a bit of, again, it's not redemption for him, but I mean, you know, he wants to create redemption for Earl in a way, because Earl has said that he was, like, a crappy dad, and...
And this is certainly one of those scenes where it's just embarrassing. Like, again, you don't know much about this Phil guy. And he's, like, almost in – you can see him on the verge of, like, hysterical tears about, like, doing this thing for this guy that he barely knows. Mm-hmm. And it's – you know, I could even – you know, even watching it, you know, now in just it selected and on its own, you get that kind of, like – bubbling feeling of like, you know,
yeah,
it's confusing because at the one time you sympathize with somebody you see clearly going through something, on the other hand there's this other thing where you're like, why? Which I think it's on purpose. I think it's, you know,
oh, definitely. I mean, even just the way, again, through we've said how it was shot, but the way it's like lit, he's wearing, we're saying that he loved this outfit of these,
just like scrubs,
light, but it's like these light blue scrubs, and so it's just really like this is just, yeah, it's like a white turtleneck or something.
Right.
But point being, it's just this really, like, you know, and he's fair skinned and blonde, you know, blonde hair, and so, and the background is just dark behind him, so it's just really like, this is what you're getting right now, like the only thing, like, and then that But it adds to it is that also there's the like the score going underneath, which, by the way, the music in this movie is phenomenal.
Oh my God, it was giving me a heart attack.
Yeah.
Like the music that...
It's just very, like, it's beautiful and haunting and, like, brings a level of, like, a slow, like, boiling anxiety.
Yeah, anxiety, that was the word. Like, it's just like a...
Yeah, it's
and
just
it's,
anxiety.
And it is pretty much... I mean, I can't say this for sure, but, like, my... I feel like it is there's always music. You know, like, the whole...
Yeah.
Like, the score is, like, one continuous flowing thing.
And I know he said it was too long, and maybe that's true, but I think that score and that almost... It's almost like the heartbeat of the film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it keeps me in for 3 hours.
Yeah, and it's sonically, you know... pulls the thread between this isn't like Babel or Crash or one of these movies where, like, you know, everybody, I mean, people are connected in this movie, but it's not in, like, you know, for cheesy moralizing reasons.
But
formally the movie is doing things to bring them together, you know.
Yeah.
The music is doing it, the style, all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, you just made me think of Crash. I don't like thinking
best
of Crash.
Picture.
Yeah, I know, exactly. That piece of crap on that one's best picture.
Yeah.
Although our next podcast is going to be a Brendan Fraser one. And
oh, true,
one.
Yeah. No.
The Jungle. Yeah, but that scene is just... Well, that's just that's a scene, like, there's this beautiful... And I want to save this for when our podcast is coming to an end, but I want to post it. It's this beautiful, this homage to Philip Seymour Hoffman's career, and it's like 20 minutes long and just has so many of his performances
in
it. And this was in it just because it really, like, and they play even like that whole time of him speaking, but other footage from movies that just, like, relate thematically to what he's saying in this movie. And
yeah.
It's just, it really is. It's just, I think it's what, you know, he's trying to be a hero in a way, but, you know, again, not for selfish reasons, but he's doing something heroic that would, you know, that everyday people experience that is, like, heroism. You know, it's not, you know, your firefighter or your, you know,
yeah,
soldier level stuff, but just someone going out on a limb and trying their hardest to create something beautiful for somebody.
And, yeah.
Yeah, a moment. I mean, I'm sure he's seen so many people die in front of him. And
yeah.
I mean, like, it's again, like, he's, the way he puts it is just perfect. I want to just kind of keep talking about his storyline / the son,
yeah,
Tom Cruise.
Yeah. I mean,
because, like, they're the most, like, intertwined here. It's not, again, not every character is connected here, which is nice. Like, I know you just mentioned Crash and Babel, where it's not,
right,
like, you know. They're more like a couple threads.
Yeah.
No, like, Tom Cruise is also the cousin of the kid who's on the show. It's not, like, you know.
Right.
But this, we'll keep it to these four characters of, like, Frank, Linda, Earl, and Phil. And they are my four favorite characters and actually the actors that I think give the strongest performances in this movie. I really liked Julianne Moore, like, before we started this podcast, but through Boogie Nights, again, a movie that I'd seen plenty of times, Big Lebowski, but just paying that much more attention to these films, she is just one of the greatest actors, just a treasure as far as, like, I mean her performance and what she brings.
Yeah, the that pharmacy scene is sort of like,
oh, it's just like excruciating.
If there was ever a scene of, like, somebody just, like, you know, like, I'm gonna show you what I got, you know, like, that is that scene.
Yeah, like, she doesn't have a reel now, obviously.
Right, right, that's the real scene.
But that, exactly.
That's the scene you put on your reel.
That's on her reel.
Absolutely.
It's not Lost World, Jurassic Park.
Yeah, you can pretty much just, you know, put that scene and have that be your reel, and probably you'll be okay.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah.
And then she even, like I said briefly, she comes back. I mean, she has a couple of interactions with Phil because...
Yeah, she's coming and going.
Yeah. But, I mean, her big thing is that she knows that she's a trophy wife and that she's also, like, a couple of her... She has a scene with a lawyer that she's trying to change the will.
Yeah, she loves this guy now.
Yeah.
She never expected that. She knew she was marrying him for the money. She cheated on him all the time. Cheating is a big thing in this film.
Yeah.
Or people admitting that they've cheated and, like, dealing with that guilt.
Well, that is also... I don't want to get off topic, but that's a big conversation with the John C. Reilly with Jim and Claudia is, like... let's just be honest and cut that bullshit out. Like, let's just say everything that's on our mind and, like, what is wrong with us.
Again, I know these characters are connected, but what's more connected is the things they're going through.
Yes.
And that's so much better than, like, the... And they're not things like racism, you know, or...
Right.
Yeah.
Love, or...
Right.
It's Valentine's Day, you know? It's like...
yeah, they're emotional arcs that are similar, and I think again that this is something that he has that he learned through Altman, you know, like Nashville is sort of organized in the same way, I feel like, that though in a more obtuse kind of like distant way, you know. It's almost like a science experiment where he just like designed, you know, a dozen different people, put them in the most high stakes emotional moments in their lives, and then just like smash them together in like a particle accelerator, you know.
Crashes.
Stop with the crash references.
This movie is actually Crash.
This is a prequel.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I thought when I was seeing it. I was like, yeah, no.
Yeah.
So she's like in this state, and he's in like.
They're in the exact opposite states of one another, Phil and Linda.
And I like how you brought that up. I guess, like, someone else has seen. Like, he's just the most different character in this film.
Yeah.
And you really see it here.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, like, she is at her low, and he's has this high moment of this excitement of wanting to, you know, to tell her, like, I got Frank's number, and then, I guess, not knowing that she would have such... opposition to that.
And you have to remember something too, like he doesn't have almost any stakes in this game here. If this guy dies, he dies, like not to, you know, not to be Drago, but he's like I said, he's seen so many people die, and you can tell that from the scene when he's like telling that other nurse like to go home that he'll see it out. Mm-hmm. He's not like, oh, I'll see this out, you know. He's kind of just like, I'll see this one out, you know. Like you know. And we don't see dialogue. It's not like, see what out, what's going on. Like, the other nurse gets it because that other nurse has probably been through that same
thing. Yeah, they're just people. It's like almost...
The stakes are lower for him, so he can perform almost higher.
Yeah. Everybody sort of goes into scenes with secrets. You know, Julianne Moore seems to have some kind of, you know, drug problem, or certainly, you know, it's just... on the brink of some emotional edge. Tom Cruise has a history with his mother that is sensitive to him. William H. Macy has this desire to get braces to impress the man of his dreams. But Philip Seymour Hoffman doesn't really have a secret. He's just like, he's all very like on the surface, which is
interesting. Face value.
Yeah, it's sort of like...
Which he and John C. Reilly are kind of similar in that way, but John C. Reilly, his only thing is that, like, he clearly knows that this woman has, like, issues, and he's kind of being like, I can put you back together.
Yeah, he's got the religion stuff, too, which gives him a little bit... It's interesting, because, like, the Philip Seymour Hoffman character is, by any, like, standard screenwriting book definition, like, he's a bad character. You know, like, there's not much going on under the surface, but somehow it is still compelling.
Yeah.
Which is...
Yeah, funny. Bad meaning like a not interesting...
Well, in just the traditional, in like the, you know, traditional three-act Hollywood structure, you know, like, he doesn't have a backstory or subtext that the audience is tracking within scenes. He's just, like... Everything is just kind of surface level.
Because as we're saying this, it almost sounds like we're insulting him or his performance. And
but which I'm not. Because
no, and I'm not either.
It's almost that, like, as an actor, he had to fill the whole role with the stuff that wasn't there. You know, it's like the role itself is... It's almost a background part. You know what I mean? It's just like he's the male nurse who takes care of the guy. Yeah. And, like, occasionally talks to him and then, like, has a phone call with a bodega owner. and, like, it's if it had just been, like, another person playing this part, it might have just been that.
We cite this guy a lot because they did fight for roles at the beginning. And again, we're not dissing him necessarily, but imagine Jack Black in this role, you know?
Yeah, it would just be a little too, like, him...
He would just play it as a comedy. He would just play... And you could easily play this simple role as, like, a super funny character, an over-the-top character even. Yeah. But that's not what Philip Seymour Hoffman does. It's not a lot to work with.
No, but I think that shows, like, the trust and what, you know, P.T. Anderson knew he would get from Philip Seymour Hoffman.
For sure.
And not that, like, obviously we can, different people can relate to different characters in this movie, but he's the most, like, oh, you know, like, I guess, like, easily relatable, or, you know, like, our little, like, our, that, like, we could just be, like, if I was that guy, you know, I don't know.
When you say easiest relatable, I know what you mean.
You yeah. Because like, we don't want to be, like, this movie, like,
it feels uncomfortable. Like, we relate to the other characters, yeah. But that feels uncomfortable.
We don't
want to
think of those uncomfortable situations that we've been into that will relate with them. So right. We'll just be like, we want to be the nice nurse that right. is trying to connect the family together again.
Who's
yeah.
just like being a sleuth, you
yeah.
know? Like,
yeah, yeah.
In a way, this is like the detective story. In the,
it is, it is. Yeah. So just to fill in the gaps here.
Yeah.
Tom Cruise's character. I keep forgetting his name. TJ or
TJ
whatever.
Mackey.
TJ Mackey.
Sounds like an 80s.
TJ Mackey. He's doing this interview this whole time, and it's kind of like this is where we learn about the how his
yeah,
relationship
because
with
of
the
good
mom
reporting.
And like how he's just like a liar essentially.
Yeah.
And
Tom Cruise was on like a Donald Trump like realm of like this is fake news.
Right.
Yeah, and basically he says that he has a good relationship with his mother and his father is dead, and
yeah.
it's actually like.
His mother has yeah passed away.
He had to take care of her and the father. I don't know. Is it clear? Did he just leave them?
I mean, he just like wasn't. He was wealthy. He's the owner of like the network.
Yeah, he ends up being
that,
the producer.
The producer of that the TV show.
The Bigger Hall show. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, it's not the specifics aren't said. But point being, like, Earl was not. He was not faithful. He was not a good husband, and then particularly not good in the sense that he was not there for his wife and for his son when she was, you know, sick and passing and through a lot of pain because she died of cancer as well. So, I mean, we get Tom
You
Cruise.
Get it. Like, I mean, he could easily say, why should I be there for him right now?
Yeah, but right. he shows up. I mean, Frank took the big, you know, step of coming here, and first we don't even see him on camera. He's outside the house, and then like in the rain, and then he comes in, and he says that line of "they'll dropkick the dogs." I mean, that's definitely.
I mean, our character Phil though has achieved his goal here.
Yeah, this is mission accomplished, and now he just escorts them finally down to.
Have we mentioned that these two will co-star in Mission Impossible?
No, we have not.
That's
so.
Right.
They
meet again.
Yes. Same characters.
Yeah, same exact characters.
Yes.
Yeah. No. Kind of.
Same characters, same dynamic.
Anyway, long story short, there. What do you think of the conversation that Tom Cruise has with his dying father?
I mean, it's very much what I expected to happen, that at first he's just very, like, you know, like, fuck you, you're a selfish asshole, and then he just realizes, like, still in the end of the day that, like, this guy is his father, and he's just so weak and helpless, and he sees Earl, like, his, you know, dying breath, but that's, I mean... Right when frogs decide to fall from the sky, so
yes, this infamous frog scene we've been alluding to. So it rains frogs for no particular reason.
Yeah, and Philip Seymour Hoffman is like the only person that decides to have like everyone. I mean, everyone's like screaming and freaking out in their own right ways, but he just goes, "Why are frogs falling from the sky?" This is very. I mean, do you guys have any like theories on this or what this is supposed to?
Have you heard anything?
Because no. I tried to look in. Like, I mean, and again, it doesn't help that even, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson didn't know that this was like a biblical thing. So this wasn't by him meant to be a biblical
or so
reference.
He says. I have my suspicions about
yeah, I mean, I'm not a religious
that's fair.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
that's fair.
Yeah, I think I don't know. Again, it's like this Phil guy yeah. is like right on the surface. He's the one to say like, oh, the thing that is happening on screen is a line of mine, you know? it's just interesting that he's like this kind of like totally surface level character. It's not like he's looking at the frogs and says something like, you know, the biblical end times have come, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't know. I think similar to the rest of this whole movie, the frogs is just like a moment of like reveling in like the limits of what you can do in a movie, you know. It's just another great thing in the making of is you get a sense of how complicated it was to make that happen from
oh, yeah.
a practical production
yeah,
standpoint.
Yeah.
There are people whose entire jobs for months were making realistic looking frogs to fall out of the sky.
Yeah,
and it was hard to do because you had to get them to hit the ground realistically and splatter
and
some
they had
ways.
Explosions in the pool. Cause that's the great, like it is like Philip Seymour Hoffman's face, like just says so many things, but like, and says it all
yeah.
in his reaction to this, like I don't know, horrific, but like, it's like, what do you call, if all of a sudden you did start seeing,
I don't know if it'd be horrific, but it would be.
It's like, I mean, it definitely, like, for those who, like, know of, like, biblical things, all of a sudden you would start thinking, like, what's, like, is, like, a biblical, like, storm
coming.
Certainly
give me pause.
Yes, that's for sure.
But, yeah, they had to, like, design special umbrellas that would rip in frog-shaped
yeah.
ways. And,
yeah,
like,
definitely,
you know.
Definitely check out this really
oh,
cool
man,
making.
This
of,
is,
yeah.
like, so complicated.
But it like, it. What I think about, you know, what it makes me think is just like, wow, that the movies are, when the engine of Hollywood is behind something, they can really make anything happen. And this is, it's hard to picture like a more bizarre scene to be included in a movie that was released by New Line. You know what I mean?
Yeah. On like a small, like, you know, like it's not like a blockbuster.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
It's
yeah.
just this.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I would also forgive somebody like, again, my mother watching this film, being like, what the hell was that? That's stupid.
Yeah.
I don't get this.
Yeah, for yeah. sure. I mean, there. Yeah, and in a certain way, like, yeah, they're probably right. You know what I mean? Like, there's one review, I think it was, I forget. There was one of the big like negative reviews of Magnolia when it came out, but essentially said that like the frogs raining was just like the last like death whisper of a movie that like had just totally gone off the rails. And you know, in a certain sense, I understand that. I mean, I think it's great and just, you know, so
yeah,
playful.
I could see
and,
some calling it like the jump the shark, you know, the drop
yeah,
the drop the frogs.
Yeah, it's just it's. It's certainly not the like you can't have like a mute like a murky opinion about it. You know
no,
what I mean?
It's just but you know what it is? It is just like this great visual thing that again like besides this song that our like main characters sing at one point in the movie, mm-hmm. and then like their thematic like what they're going through. This is just a connective. Tissue and like how else do you, how do you like not that this is the end it ends with this it ends with like Claudia and her smile
mm-hmm.
but what else is going to be like the connective climax of this movie. You don't want the again nothing but freaking crash and like them interacting outside of their own little moments and being
right.
like oh you know like the Mexican guy that was putting the lock on the door is a good guy, and you know, like, he's,
right?
It's just what it's just one of those things that you have to accept the unknown, I guess. Like, it's just it falls into that, and I enjoy it just because it is over the top to me. Like, that's just,
oh yeah, and like gleefully so.
Yeah.
So I was reading a lot of the reviews now that you touched on that, and some people who didn't like it. Like the first 2 hours.
Right.
And just to them, like I think you mentioned, it completely fell apart to them in the last hour.
Okay.
And I could see the frog thing being a very big reason for that.
Yeah, big time. Where do we leave PSH in this movie?
So the last we see of Phil Parma is that, you know, Earl is passed, and then I guess, you know, you call up whatever service comes and takes away you know, the body of the deceased, and they take the dog as well that overdosed. But he's just kind of quietly folding up. You don't even really see, but he's just like, it's pretty tight shot, but it's just like him folding what I assume is like the bed sheets. And he's kind of like quietly like weeping, crying to himself, just because I just threw like, this is, you know, is what he just went through of bringing a family back together, hearing, I mean, and Philip Seymour Hoffman said that it was just so just like intimidating and just like amazing, and that Tom Cruise actually like improvised a lot as far as what he was saying to Earl, and so he just said it was just like one of the best like raw performances he ever experienced. So just like from that, he had that as an actor, like he definitely then also then, since they shot in chronological order, I think he just took all of that and said, what did my guy just go through, and what else would he be doing besides just like kind of like weeping from all these emotions?
Yeah.
But the movie ends with a smile.
Yeah.
I mean, this,
despite
again,
all the crying, it ends with a smile.
Yeah.
Is there any specific scenes you wanted to touch on? Characters?
I mean, there's, this
again,
is a movie,
like,
again,
we could spend 3 hours.
Yeah.
So, but, I mean, it's not worth it. Watch Magnolia. Take out some time
watch
to watch
Magnolia
it.
And then, no, but really take the time to watch this making of. It's just a really fun, just like little view into what it took to making this movie and just what it takes, you know, it just makes
yeah,
you
I
appreciate.
Yeah, I had actually not seen that, so I definitely want to check that out.
And the, yeah, and it particularly captures, like, it's hard to imagine that this kind of movie where a major studio puts significant financial and creative firepower into a big art movie, essentially. It's hard to imagine that this will really ever happen again.
Ever.
I mean, it sort of does happen in TV, but
I'm curious what kind of budget, like, a Terrence Malick film has, because he's definitely up there as far
sure.
as...
Sure, yeah. I don't think... it would be interesting to compare... Yeah, I don't know. But I know that... certainly recently, I mean, PTA 2, they're getting their financing from more independent sources than, you know, it's not, they're not major releasing.
No, no.
It's like Annapurna is now funding PTA movies, and like, thank God for Annapurna and like that company just keeping good stuff alive, but it's just not, it's not this, it's not New Line, it's not, you know, like, who knows? I don't know what the budget for Magnolia was, but it was large. They shot for like 120 days or something.
Yeah, something. Yeah, it was something crazy. Like, it was supposed to be 79 days, and actually it was like 90 days of principal photography, but then like 10 more of just,
it's
even like...
$37 million. I thought it'd be more.
Okay.
But
oh,
it,
wow.
it made
yeah.
48.
So. Yeah, I mean, no. But 37 is...
Well, that's not an indie budget. You
know?
Oh,
no,
yeah,
exactly.
Definitely not.
That's oh, so speaking of like budget and all that kind of stuff, you know, we always touch on this. 84% critic wise on Rotten Tomatoes, like 89% audience, which is interesting to me. I wouldn't think the audience would be higher than the critical for a kind of film like this. But
so 84 and 89.
Yeah,
that's
you think
very...
that's fair? You think it should be higher?
No, that's a pretty, like, that's like a pleasing, that just makes me, you know.
To me, it's especially pleasing because this could be so hit or miss with people, and I would expect, like, because Rotten Tomatoes is critical consensus, right? Mm-hmm. I would expect more critics to be like, just fuck this shit.
Right.
And I guess not, which is,
yeah.
It's just nice. It's nice to see.
Yeah.
I guess, I mean, like, that's Magnolia.
Yeah, I think I'm going to get a little picture of a magnolia put in my apartment now. It just
yeah.
is a little...
yeah, there was one in the background of this podcast. I don't know if you heard it.
You know, I think we...
yeah. I'm not looking around it.
I think we figured it out, though. I think, yeah, we have all the answers.
Yeah, exactly.
yeah.
We know Magnolia.
We're the quiz kid.
Yeah.
yeah. Maybe I'm the prophet. Who knows? So... So, Tim, thanks so much for coming.
Yeah, thanks
today.
For
thanks.
Letting me come and
Do you have anything about the movie? Website, Instagram,
where can people find you?
I've got it won't be done for a little bit, but I shot a feature film over the summer, which will be my first feature.
Awesome.
It's called The Undiscovered Country. It'll be some time until it's out in the world, but hopefully sooner rather than later. So,
what's it about?
It is about a young woman whose mother dies, and she goes on a strange quest to figure out, to discover like her mother's secret past.
Okay. So like Crash.
Yeah, it's like Crash. Crash.
No, that sounds great. Awesome.
It's a ghost story. She follows her mother's ghost, and which is how this whole thing comes about.
That's really
cool. That's cool.
Yeah,
it's like a lot of fun shooting it.
Weird psychological drama.
Do you have like a Facebook page for it or anything?
I do. Yeah. Okay. You can.
What's the name?
I forget what the. I think if you Google Facebook, The Undiscovered Country, it'll come up. I think. Hopefully.
Perfect. All fans, check it. You know, just. We'll keep them up to date with that.
Yeah.
If you keep us up to date.
Absolutely.
Anywhere else people can follow you?
Not particularly. I need to make a website for myself.
I'm right there with you, man.
You know, I have not gotten around to it. I saw a really funny Onion headline that just said Woody Allen spending most of his days updating WoodyAllen.com. The entire article is about how Woody Allen is, you know, obviously jokingly, putting a lot of time and effort into, you know, keeping up with the times and modernizing his portfolio on his Squarespace website.
We were actually talking about the other day how we would love to see Philip Seymour Hoffman in a Woody Allen film.
Oh, yeah.
That's like the missing link for us. Like
it's weird that it never happened.
Yeah, right? Because the other day, after we were talking, I was thinking of, like, films that I could, like, place him in, and it's not that difficult. He totally could play that.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
What's the one with, like, Will Ferrell and, like, Steve Carell? It's not very good.
Melinda. Yeah. I kind of like that one.
It's underrated.
Yeah.
But I could definitely see him in that. That's what I was thinking of. Whatever. We're not going to go over the whole But,
Yeah. Thank you again for coming on.
Thanks for coming on.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
Good to meet you, too.
Maybe we'll collaborate on something someday.
Totally.
Besides this.
And good luck in your journey through the universe of PSH.
It's a glorious journey thus far, and like I said, there's so many films I'm looking forward to discussing.
You're about to get scruffier. I feel like he gets scruffier.
Yes. Yeah, that's why. If anyone sees that my beard's a little longer and I've gained weight, it's just because I'm a method podcast host.
Yeah, we're method podcasters. You know. So one of the films we're going to do
next week, we've got Talented Mr. Ripley.
Very popular film, a film that a lot of people have said was the first time they had recognized him in something.
Yeah.
And we have Cage Club co-founder joining us, Michael Manzi.
Michael Manzi, can't wait to have him back.
That should be really fun. And as always, like, follow, subscribe, share.
You guys have been awesome. Hoff fans are the best fans.
Thank you. Thank you again, not Dustin Hoff fans.
No.
Philip Seymour Hoff fans.
Fans.
Was there any overlap between the two of them?
I wish we like, but no.
Nope. Unfortunately not.
Not in Hook. You would have liked that.
No, and he wasn't in Meet the Fockers.
So. Yeah. The two classic Dustin Hoffman films.
But yes, Tim, we end the episode.
Yeah, a film that's coming up, Almost Famous. We kind of begin it with that, but he says, I'm always home, I'm uncool. So we end the episode with our guest saying, stay uncool, Hoff fans. So.
Cool. Stay uncool, Hoff fans.
Boom.
Don't be cool.
weren't good with the subtext there. It's
yep. Thanks so much, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
sex-a-thing, sex-a-thing you. I believe in miracles.